This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we look at the case of Efron Perades Jr., wrongly sentenced to 3 life terms at the age of 15. We'll speak to Perades in prison since 1989 in an extraordinary case. We'll also speak to an international lawyer about violations of international law posed by the Perades case, and we'll speak to his former ninth grade teacher. Also, Catherine Austin Fitz with Community Business. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton goes to Haiti. We'll feature an on-the-ground report from Port-au-Prince and have special correspondent Kevin Pina in the studio for deep background. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Stay tuned for the Best of Flashpoints.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we continue our coverage. I guess, I don't know, Kevin, we've been working on this story together for 14 years, and it's no surprise on the 60th anniversary of Pacifica and KPFA that we are still on this subject of Haiti that has been covered up, undermined, and really totally misreported, apparently on purpose, by the AP. Of course, we have uncovered the fact that some of the AP reporters were actually working for the State Department and the government. But let me say something about what's happened. Protests are banned in Haiti as Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton arrives to bolster sham elections scheduled for Sunday. Meanwhile, a Washington-based group in the Haiti Priorities Project released a report based on a poll showing that the turnout in an upcoming Senate election, that's this Sunday, may be as low as 5%. That's sort of strange, given the fact that 70, 80, 90% would vote for Aristide. Joining us from Port-au-Prince in one moment will be Seth Donnelly. He's a member of the U.S. Labor and Human Rights Delegation, currently on the ground in Haiti. Also joining us in one moment will be Jacob Francois of the Haiti Priorities Project, coming to us from St. Lucie, Florida. In the studio, of course, with me is our own special correspondent, Kevin Pina, award-winning filmmaker, honored by Project Censored for his investigation that we had the honor to feature here on Flashpoints for the last, 14 or 15 years. All right, set the scene. Hillary goes to Haiti.
Well, the real deep background, as you call it, starts yesterday, where there is an international donors conference on Haiti, where the international community says it is going to give Haiti $320 million in assistance, economic assistance. Sounds good on the surface of it, except if you scratch a little deeper, what we know is that that money is not a penny of it is going to go directly to the Haitian government. Instead, it is going to go through the hands of nearly 4,000 non-governmental organizations who are currently in charge of every aspect of governance in that country, from sweeping the streets to elections coming up next Sunday.
Now, you say these are senatorial elections, sham elections. What do you mean by that?
Well, the largest political party, the Famille Lavalas party, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's party, has been basically effectively barred from participation on procedural grounds. Basically, the Provisional Election Council in Haiti said that there were 2 slates of candidates originally submitted. Then the leadership of the party got together. They hammered out a compromise list. And then the Conseil Electoral Provisoire, the Provisional Election Council in Haiti, said they would not accept it because the documents did not have Aristide's personal signature on it. This, of course, happening on the last date of applications.
And he's in South Africa.
And he's in South Africa.
Exiled, undermined in a coup.
And according to friends of mine who were in the press there, they who witnessed this, they said that the CEP said they would not accept a document with a that was a facsimile of his signature. The documents had to have his original signature. The last day, who's going to fly to South Africa at the last moment and get Aristide's signature? Obviously ridiculous.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Let us go, Kevin, now to Port-au-Prince, where we are joined by Seth Donnelly. Seth Donnelly, as we said, is a member of a U.S. Labor and Human Rights Delegation currently on the ground in Haiti. Seth, welcome back to Flashpoints. Tell us where you are and say a little bit more about what you're doing there.
Thanks. It's good to be back on Flashpoints. We're in Port-au-Prince, and we've been here for this week conducting extensive interviews with different sectors, different activists on the ground here in Haiti, gathering information on the reality of these upcoming elections, or as many Haitians call them, selections. And we've also been working with different popular organizations to set up some information computer centers.
Hillary Clinton, has she sat down? I understand that protests were banned while she was in the country. What can you tell us about this?
State that one more time, Dennis. It's
that we understand that protests were banned while Hillary is in the country. Tell us the mood and what's going on.
Well, as Kevin mentioned, the largest political party, which is really the mass movement of the poor majority, Familia Avalos, has been essentially banned from participating in the upcoming Senate elections on Sunday because of it's really a red herring, but the Electoral Commission has claimed it has to do with too many candidates were submitted, even though there was a clear official slate that should have been accepted. But aside from that, Familia Avalos was then going, and other supporters of democracy in Haiti were going to stage a demonstration this morning in Port-au-Prince, and the police did not authorize that, so the demonstration was not held. However, there are hunger strikers inside of the parliamentary building, and we were able to meet them and interview them and film that protest.
Hunger strikers inside the parliament. Tell us more about that. Who's in there, and what are they doing on the hunger strike?
Well, they started the hunger strike just recently. When we got there, there were five folks inside the building fasting, and then there was a larger group of supporters both inside the building, and then even more people gathered outside of the building in protest of, again, what people are calling the upcoming elections. So that is, even though the police banned larger street demonstrations, that action is underway. But even more, I guess I can wait. I wanted to give an update on the political prisoner situation as well.
In one moment, we're going to get to that. Has Hillary touched down?
I have no idea. It was all a mystery to Haitians on the ground, and to us included, what her itinerary is. It was certainly not being publicly revealed, at least as far as we could tell.
So the Secretary of State of the Obama administration, United States, the democracy, going to celebrate an election, support an election in Haiti. Protests are banned, demonstrations are banned, hunger strikes are happening, and the people on the ground who would love to be able to practice democracy don't even know what the hell is going on. Tell us about...
Folks who are active in the loss, but we met with various folks like the trade unions, women's groups, various organizations on the ground, and the sentiment coming from the street, from the people, is that these elections are just straight up shams.
So this is very being felt very strongly on the ground at the grassroots level, that these are sham elections, and that the Secretary of State, whoever knows that she's there, knows that she's there to enforce continuing oppressive policy, IMF, World Bank policy.
That's right.
All right. What we also heard from AP, of course,
Kevin,
is that Hillary Rodham Clinton was whisked from the airport in a air-conditioned motorcade of limousines, of these large fancy machines, driving through the pothole-strewn streets of Port-au-Prince. He uses very dramatic language. And, of course, all the streets were kept clear by the police. And so, of course, no one's going to know where she started, where she's going, or what was said, except those very few members of the corporate media who were allowed into the press conference.
And it's amazing, because anybody who has flown into Port-au-Prince knows that as soon as you get outside the gates of the airport, there are so many palms out and turned over that collectively they could form a large desert, and that's a desert of loss and hunger. Seth, why don't you talk a little bit about the political prisoners?
Yeah, that's been first and foremost on our minds today. We got into the National Penitentiary this morning. We were on the visiting list of one of the political prisoners, Ronald Dauphine, who's been in prison for 5 years without charges. We had received a report when we got here that his health condition is deteriorating. And there are two medical professionals on our team, one of whom has been a nurse for 35 years, and she's an active member in the healthcare union in the United States. And when we got there, it was clear he could not even walk. He had to be carried out into the prison courtyard. He collapsed in our presence with his eyes wide open, but he was unconscious, could not find a pulse for a while. He had pain all throughout his torso, which he had not urinated for over a week. It had led the professionals on our team to voice concern that he was in imminent danger of dying if he did not get medical treatment. He, when he was conscious, he was able to tell us that when he goes to the prison medical staff, he gets a painkiller injection, which lasts for about an hour and then wears off. And then it's back to the pain in the torso, which could be a septic infection throughout the body. He'd had surgery years ago for a hernia, but we don't know what's causing it, but he's clearly not getting the care he needs, let alone the habeas corpus rights he deserves. So it's paramount right now.
So that, he could die when Hillary Clinton is on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. And we met with the director or the warden of that prison, who said that in order for him to give up, he could not authorize Ronald Duffin to go to an outside clinic or hospital for treatment. But he told us we could go to the prison administration office in Petchenville, which is up further up in the hills. So we did that. We went there later in the afternoon and met with the assistant director of the prison administration there, and he said that he could not give authorization, but that a judge could, although he said he would call down to the prison medical staff to see if they could take a second look at Ronald. Right now, it's crucial that Flashpoint listeners get on the web. We cannot get the phone number before this call, but to get on the web, get the information for the Haitian Minister of Justice, and email or call the Minister of Justice and put pressure on the Minister of Justice to get Ronald Duffin medical care, because it's our concern that he could die in prison quickly.
Yeah, well, I just want our listeners to know who Ronald Duffin is. Ronald Duffin has been a political prisoner in Haiti for over 5 years. He was not arrested by the Haitian police. He was not arrested by the United Nations. He was arrested by Guy Philippe, the leader of the paramilitary death squads that came over from the Dominican Republic when they began taking over townships in February of 2004 to force out the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Guy Philippe, while he remains his paramilitary death squad leader, remains free in the streets of Port-au-Prince. Ronald Duffin, who was arrested by him, remains behind bars today in Haiti. That's exactly the kind of conditions that exist for political prisoners in Haiti today, and how on earth you can say that that's a condition, that these are conditions where you can hold free and democratic elections, I don't understand. Certainly, Hillary Rodham Clinton isn't going to say anything on behalf of Ronald Duffin in Haiti
today. And I'll tell you, a striking image, when we went into the prison, there was a UN tank mounted outside there with the soldier with the heavy weaponry guarding the prison. And that just seemed to me metaphorical of that Haiti continues to be a country under occupation with a sham democracy in which a political prisoner could die while our Secretary of State travels through the streets in an air-conditioned limousine.
All right. We are speaking to our good friend on the ground in Port-au-Prince. That's Seth Donnelly. He's a member of a U.S. labor and human rights delegation, and he has been looking in, investigating the treatment in the brutal prisons, in the deadly prisons of Port-au-Prince, of political prisoners who have been rotting in jail, many since when the United States came in and overthrew the duly constituted government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Here we have Hillary Clinton on the ground. Now, final comment, Seth. What should we know that AP and the mainstream is not bringing us?
Well, I think it's the voice of the poor majority through, the people are clearly speaking through different neighborhood organizations, through unions, through women's organizations. The people are still organizing here, despite the disillusionment with the exclusion of the majority political party from the elections. There's still a strong sense of mobilization, of not giving up, and I think it's important for us to match that energy with our own in the United States, to put, in this case, immediately contact the Minister of Justice in Haiti and demand treatment for Ronald Duffin, but on a broader level, maintain solidarity with the people's struggle for democracy in Haiti.
So you're saying that despite the fact that the largest political party has essentially been marginalized, if not banned, the spirit of that party, that movement, despite all the repression, continues to be very strong, even if people are risking their lives to practice democracy.
Oh, that's clear. You know, this coup's been going on for 5 years, and what people are saying here is that the elections or the selections are an extension of the coup, and that they're clear that they're still under an occupation government, that there's still a coup regime in place, but that doesn't mean that people give up. They keep on doing what they need to do, and so should we.
All right, Seth Donnelly on the ground in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints. Please be careful. We will check back with you very quickly.
Now, as far as the case of...
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Dennis, but thank you so much, Seth. I just want our listeners to know that you can find that information of how to contact and write and fax and email the Minister of Justice in Haiti on the website ijdh.org, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. They just recently launched a campaign to free Ronald Dauphin in Haiti.
We now continue, though, as we do every Wednesday, with our regular economic segment called Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, welcome to Flashpoints, and we are delighted to have you help us celebrate Pacifica on its 60th anniversary. And we will open up the phones in a few minutes for people who want to dialogue with you on a very special part of the bailout. But let me say welcome, and thank you for all your contributions, Catherine.
Happy birthday, Dennis.
It's close to my birthday, too. I was born within a few days of Pacifica. I wonder if there's a connection. Conspiracy theorists and all that. Well, we continue to do the work, and we're happy to have you with us. Let me read to you just a little bit, Catherine, off this, just ripped off the wire through the internet. This is from Market Watch, and it goes something like this. Lloyd Blankenfein must be the luckiest guy on Wall Street. He leads one of the streets. I love that. The street's biggest bailout firms. But unlike the other companies propped up by the taxpayers, Blankenfein's Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. is far more profitable, and it's poised to become a more influential force with greater market share. Different from American International, that's AIG, or Citigroup, Goldman hasn't had to forfeit any ownership stake in its firm, and its shareholders, many of them management and employees, have benefited. Wow. Goldman shares trade above 100 bucks. That's less than half of where Goldman shares traded at their peak, but far better than the $1 and $3 that AIG and Citigroup shares trade for, respectively. Wow. Goldman Sachs, what's your reaction?
Well, there's no doubt that Goldman has done a very profitable job of manipulating the government. Goldman has been the beneficiary of both government investment during the bailout and was the winner in the AIG bailout. The biggest chunk of money going through AIG went to Goldman Sachs for essentially insurance provided for some of this toxic paper. And it was Goldman that got, last year, there was an emergency effort by Treasury and the government to allow some of the investment banks to become holding companies so that they could use government guarantees in the form of FDIC insurance to access funding. And it's fair to say, Dennis, if it wasn't, and this was not just me speaking, it's the Wall Street Journal had a very interesting editorial today about Goldman Sachs. If it wasn't for the bailouts, I doubt Goldman Sachs would be in existence today. And yet Goldman Sachs says they just raised $5 billion of capital from stock sales, and they want to pay the government back so that they can continue to pay a very large number of employees, over $1 million a year.
They've also started paying a very high-powered law firm to make sure that nobody says anything terrible about them.
I know.
Tell us about that law firm.
You know,
they're right on. They're going after a blogger now, aren't they?
Yeah, they're going after. Apparently, they've hired, according to the reports, they've hired, I believe it's Chadburn Park, to go after a blogger who's going after them.
And in fact, they're going to sue him for 15 cents?
The top story on my blog is that Goldman Sachs amasses war chest. You know, they've put together quite a cash store now, and it will be interesting. Many of the reports, I'm a member of a group called the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and we try and lobby against and illuminate management of the precious metals market. And, of course, that always leads you into watching how the markets are managed. But our guess is Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase are the leaders on behalf of the government, probably the Exchange Stabilization Fund, in really managing the markets. And, of course, if you have the inside information that you would get managing both stock and precious metals markets for the government, imagine how much money you can make.
And, of course, Goldman Sachs now, because they are doing so well, they are sort of reaching out, they're paying back their debts to the government, and they're going to help people. They're having community input.
Well, it's funny because as I told you, I'm on their alumni network because I was a summer employee once upon a time at Goldman Sachs. And, so I got my little email today, and as I'm reading about the various sort of manipulations of what they're up to, in comes the email saying that they're announcing their next round of community works programs. And
community works programs. What is it? Is that like Timothy Geithner gets a job?
I always feel at times like this, and I thought, I need to do something more positive today than that. I feel like writing and saying, when Goldman Sachs partners are in the vicinity at Mena, Arkansas, Maybe you should just stop, like, helping to rape Russia and stuff like that. Maybe that's what communities need you to do.
And they still hold sway in the government.
Let's look at who's who. I mean, the New York Fed is the mothership in the Federal Reserve System. That's where the greatest power lies. And the New York Fed is owned by its member banks, and presumably Goldman Sachs is one of them. So when you say the Fed, it's not necessarily that different from Goldman Sachs. And now when you say Treasury, if you look at the who's been the Secretary of the Treasury and their sort of various relationships with Goldman Sachs, one of my favorite quotes in the blog was from a taxi driver, I think, is in Sumatra in Indonesia, saying, "What's the matter with your country? Why do you allow yourself to be run by Goldman Sachs?" Now, if a taxi cab driver in the streets of Asia is asking that story, then certainly it's time for us to ask it as well.
And in terms of this citizen outreach, paying back the government, whose money are they paying us back with?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, but let's just say that one of the things that saved them was the ability to use the federal credit to basically, issue insured CDs to raise capital. We're putting our money, we as the taxpayers are giving a government guarantee, and then we as investors are giving our money, in the form of CDs that we're attracting with our own guarantees, and that's financing all of this. So my guess is, if you look at all the different people and institutions that have brokerage and other accounts with Goldman Sachs, we're providing our money for this.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Catherine Austin Fitz. And when you talk about the New York Fed, am I remembering correctly, but didn't they once offer you a job?
No, I was asked by the Secretary of the Treasury to be a governor of the Federal Reserve System. The board of governors in Washington, and when people hear about the chairman is the board of that governors, is a hybrid appointed by the president and with various approval. So it's a presidential appointee. So the Board of Governors is a hybrid. The individual banks around the country are owned by their members.
All right, let me tell people, this is Catherine Austin Fitz. She used to be the Assistant Secretary of Housing under the first Bush administration, and she is our advisor between Wall Street and Main Street. Catherine Austin Fitz, you want to communicate with her, solari.com/blog. Catherine, as always, we appreciate having you, and hopefully we'll be together 60 more years. And you take care.
Dennis, to you in Pacifica.
Time sifts through the hourglass, through night and day, and I watch as the games people play. It's like do unto others, then split. And if you can't back up what you say, then you ain't shit. I've seen the manifestations of the street, so I can manifest what I see on a drum beat. Like just last night.
You know what happened?
I watched these two rivals get in a crazy fight. One of them was quick to pull a knife. He stabbed him in the heart, and now he's doing life in prison at the age of 21. Living on death row, cause he couldn't let go. Caught in the web of violence. Roll deep when they creep and move in silence of the lambs.
Yo.
A tattooed teardrop as the iron gates slam.
Ain't no sunshine.
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 Anytime. Hey.
Ain't no sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine. Anytime.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. The United States is the leader among nations when it comes to the barbaric practice of locking up juvenile offenders, yes, kids, to life without the chance of parole. I want to read a little bit to you based on a press release about Efron Paredes, Jr., learn about 15-year-old Latino honor student named Efron Paredes Jr., who was wrongly convicted in 1989 for a murder and armed robbery he did not commit. The crime occurred in St. Joseph, Michigan. The case against Efron was entirely circumstantial. There was no physical evidence linking Efron to the crime, no eyewitness to the crime, and Efron was home with his parents, his mom says, and two brothers when the crime occurred. Efron Paredes now joins us. Where exactly are you, Efron, and welcome.
How you doing, Dennis?
It's good to have you with us. Tell us about where you are right now when you speak with us.
I'm at the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility in Jackson, Michigan.
And how long have you been there?
I've been here for approximately 8 years at this facility.
8 years, and then before that, another 12 somewhere else?
At various different facilities throughout the state of Michigan, correct.
So you grew up in prison?
Essentially, yes. I've been in prison since the age of 15, and I've never been out.
And you were in ninth grade when you were convicted.
I was a sophomore.
You were in 10th grade. You were a sophomore.
Right.
All right. Did you kill this man?
No, I did not. I had nothing to do with the crime. I had nothing to do with the planning of the crime. I had no knowledge of it. And I was in no way involved whatsoever before, during, or after the crime.
Tell us how it was. Your mom says that you were home with her.
Correct. The crime happened at a grocery store in the town of St. Joseph, Michigan. It's a town of about 7,000 people, and it's about 95% white. That's important. The racial factor, the racial composition of the town, is important for what we'll talk about later. The night that the crime occurred, I actually worked at the grocery store where it happened, and the store manager drove me home that evening, and he returned to the store where after that time, sometime during that night, which even the police and the autopsy person was unable to determine when the murder happened. But I never left my home that night. I was home with my family, and that's what happened.
And what kind of student? You were pretty much into school at the time, weren't you?
Yeah, I was an honor student. I participated in German Club and Key Club. I also participated in Junior Achievement. I played soccer. I also ran track at the time.
All right, you just had a record-long parole hearing. I think they said it was either 6 or 9 hours. Is that correct?
9 hours long.
9 hours long. What did you tell the parole? What was you? Could you make that case for us?
Yeah, the hearing was held here in Jackson as well, and it was also the most widely attended hearing. Probably close to 200 people were present, and the vast majority of those people, with probably the exception of maybe 30 people, were my supporters. And we talked about my case. I talked about my innocence, and I also discussed the issue of juvenile life without parole, because that's also a factor in my case. You know, I was sentenced to 2 life without parole sentences for 1 homicide, and I was sentenced to 1 parolable life sentence for armed robbery. The guidelines, sentencing guidelines for the armed robbery were 36 to 96 months. 3 to 8 years. So we argued that. We argued about, you know, the disproportionality of sentencing. We talked about my positive accomplishments, which was a major factor. All the things that I've achieved. I earned my GED at the age of 16 in prison. And I went on to attend college, earn about 30 college credits before they removed the Pell Grant. And I could no longer attend. And then I went on to become a certified literary braille transcriber by the U.S. Library of Congress, which I also discussed with them. And I, one of the things that I made very clear to the parole board was that I would not accept responsibility for a crime that I did not commit under no circumstances.
And you said even if you could walk out the door at that second, you would not admit to a crime you didn't commit.
That's absolutely true.
And we know that it's the parole board is looking for sort of a sense of you admitting you're wrong and stepping up to the plate, and but you're not going to change anything about your demeanor or your story because you are maintaining your total innocence.
No, I will not. I told the parole board, I understand that's detrimental to the possibility that they could release me. But one thing I will not do is I'm not going to lie, and I'm not going to take responsibility for something that I did not do under no circumstances, whether it meant leaving prison that day or whether it meant leaving prison 20 years ago. I think it's important to add that I was arrested at age 15. Had I pled guilty at that time, if I was truly guilty of the case, I would have likely been sentenced as a juvenile and been released by age 21 at the latest, because I had no previous record of any sort, and because of my positive school record and everything that I had going. So I had the opportunity to plead guilty and be released at the latest 6 years after my incarceration. I refused to do it. And even in retrospect, if we look back, you know, people have asked me, you know, Ephraim, you've been in prison 20 years. If there was 20 years, if you could do it all over again, would you plead guilty to this case? And the answer to that is absolutely not.
Now, if you maintain that you did not commit this crime, you did not kill this man, do you have any idea who did? Was the police investigation, do you believe, thorough? Do you have any ideas here?
Actually, we do. The police investigation was not thorough. It was a rush to judgment. The case was based primarily on the statements, testimony of other youth. And we later found out that the key prosecution witness in the case was a drug dealer at the time, which we didn't learn until 10 years later. And we also just recently learned, as early as Wednesday of this week, 20 years after my imprisonment, that someone has come forth with information, a gentleman in Florida, about this same prosecution witness setting him up as well. So this is newly discovered evidence that we will be bringing forth very soon. As far as the evidence, the money admittedly found from the crime scene, the gun, there were newspaper clippings from the crime and the actual automobile that was used during the commission of the crime all belong to the persons, two of the persons that pled guilty to the crime. They pled guilty to armed robbery and second-degree murder in this exact same case. And they did that in exchange for leniency to testify against me.
So you are saying that the people who actually were convicted for the crime gave you over to the system in order to get a better deal?
Absolutely.
And where are they now? Are they in jail?
They have served, two of the gentlemen served 18 years, and they've been released. They've been out for about 3 years now. Two other gentlemen, the one that was a drug dealer at the time, he never received any sentence whatsoever. He was a young white youth, and another white youth received a six-month sentence in the juvenile facility, and both of the white youth were older than me at the time that this happened.
Now, how was your attorney? How did he do for you?
Very inept. I had deficient trial counsel.
How so?
Well, he didn't do a good. He didn't perform any investigation into my case. He didn't call any character witnesses to talk about me as an individual. He didn't. There were a number of legal strategies that could have been done, peremptory challenges that I don't think were made properly, things dealing with evidence. I never even saw the police reports in my case until after I was in prison, after I was convicted and sent to prison.
We're speaking with Efren Parades. He is serving, I guess, two life sentences without the possibility of parole for a crime he says he did not commit. He was convicted at the age of 15 and has been in jail ever since. We're going to expand the conversation in one moment. Let me explain to the audience that at a certain point you're going to be cut off, and hopefully we'll be able to have you call us back and continue the dialogue. And we will have guests in the studio, and we'll also be speaking to your teacher, who was your teacher at the time you were convicted, about what kind of student you were back then. But I really want you to speak to us now, if you could, from the heart, also with your own life experience. What has it been like for you to be inside jail for so long and knowing that in your heart you feel that you are absolutely innocent, and knowing, as you say, you know, that you are? Does that, what's that like? Does it make it more difficult? No.
You have 1 minute
left. You're innocent. You can just start here, and we'll keep it going.
Okay. It's been absolutely devastating. It's been very difficult to deal with 20 years of incarceration. It, 1 year of incarceration, 1 day of incarceration is absolutely difficult for any adult to have to endure. But for a juvenile, it's all the more difficult, and especially because of my innocence, because I've had to live day in and day out languishing inside prison, knowing that I did not commit a crime, and knowing that people that probably did commit the crime are free in society, and they basically were able to get away with it with just a slap on the wrist. You know, it's been, everything else has been taken from me, my family, my friends, my freedom, everything that people live or experience during their life between the age of 15 and now I'm 36 years old. I've never had the opportunity to experience those things.
Thank you for using Embark.
We will be back with Efren, and we're going to be back talking with Connie de la Vega. She is a professor of international law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. She has written a report about sentencing our children to die in prison, and that's what we're talking about. And the United States, I guess along with Israel, is leading the charge. I personally still have nightmares about an interview I did with Douglas Christopher Thomas, who was executed, I guess, by the state of Virginia a number of years ago, and was the last person to speak to this young man alive. It's a troubling situation when you kill children. We'll be right back to talk more about it.
what they say. Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real.
But it is real, this situation that so many children, young people in this country face. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Efren Paredes is serving a life sentence for a crime he says he did not commit. And it is interesting, Efren, the way you were cut off there, it's sort of the way you were cut off from your life.
Yeah.
Just chopped out of it. You want to pick it up?
Sure. Yeah, Dennis, it was... I spent more time of my life in prison than I did a 15-year-old boy in society. As I mentioned, I'm 36 years old now. Spent over 20 years in prison. So all the things that... I mean, when I came to prison, there was no cell phones. There were no MP3 players. There was no internet. There has been a... Life is as I knew it then is much different, and I've had this. You know, I've seen children and my two brothers. I've seen them. You know, I've missed their marriages and a lot of different things that have happened in our family. You know, events.
This call is from the Michigan Department of Corrections.
The birth of a niece and a nephew, and you know, just the children that have been raised. Earlier this year, I saw one of my cousins who I held in my arms when I first came to prison in 1989 as a baby. And I saw her for the first time after all these years as a mature young woman. Now she's 20 years old.
What did you learn? What do you learn as a kid and a young person about survival when you're behind bars? What were those lessons like?
Those lessons are difficult as well because you don't know, you can't trust anyone. You don't know who you can talk to. You don't know what you can do, what you can't do. No one gives you a handbook about being a 15-year-old and going to an all-adult prison. And in Michigan, in other states, they have juvenile prisons for people that have been sentenced as adults. In Michigan, when I came to prison, there was none. So I went to, I was in all-adult prisons. During that time, up until now, and it's been youth have that are in adult prisons have a much higher rate of being assaulted, of being taken advantage of, and people want to steal from them or people want to hurt them. It's something that they live and have to endure daily, you know, in fear. They live in fear their entire lives as young people in prison.
Well, let me again invite you to spend some time with your former teacher, Inga Longpre. She's on the line. Inga Longpre, you still believe very much in your former student, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Tell us why. What you know that maybe we don't yet understand.
Well, first of all, he was an excellent student. He was always friendly, polite, considerate. There was no indication to me that he would be in any way capable of committing such a crime. He was well-respected by his classmates. He was well-respected by his teachers. He was an honor student. He got excellent grades. He went out of his way to help with anything that you needed help with. He was the treasurer of the German Club, of which I was the advisor. He was always very helpful along those lines. He was responsible for, thousands of dollars when we had our fundraisers and so forth, and there was never any indication that he would have mishandled any of the funds. I mean, he was just the type of student that every teacher dreams about having.
Well, you're also still his teacher, I guess. You helped him set up a blog?
Well, I would say he helped me set it up because he read so much about it that he probably knew more about it than I did. But, you know, he does not have access to the Internet, so I was able to do it for him.
So, Efron, what kind of a teacher was Miss Longpre? Did she do a good job?
Oh, she was a great teacher. She was my favorite teacher, and she was not only what I consider to be a good teacher in terms of academics, but I think that she was a very positive role model, and she also taught. It was important to her to teach life skills and to her students as well.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. In one moment, we're going to be speaking with Connie de la Vega. She's a professor, international law at University of San Francisco School of Law. She has written a very troubling and compelling report, Sentencing Our Children to Die in Prison. Right now, we're speaking with Efron's teacher, and that's Inge Longpre. And say a little bit more about perhaps Efron, if you would have had the chance, what were you hoping back in 9th and 10th grade? Where were you heading? What was your dream then?
I eventually wanted to go on to college. I wasn't really sure whether I wanted to go into business or go into law, but those are some things that were kind of interesting to me. But I definitely had hopes and dreams of doing that, perhaps maybe going on to play soccer at college, and doing some positive things with my life. Despite having come to prison, I've continued to follow on that track in terms of continuing to educate myself, continuing to help people both inside prison and outside of prison, and use my life in a positive way.
What do you tell the victim in terms of there's a lot of anger within law enforcement and within the family? How dare you, this hardened killer, ask for freedom? Have you looked eye to eye with the victims who you say you're innocent of the crime, but you're still related? You're still now here connected in history.
I have not had the opportunity to speak with them directly. I saw them at the public hearing. I saw them in court at the courtroom 20 years ago. So I haven't been able to speak with them directly, but I have expressed my I'm deeply sorry for what happened to their family. It was a senseless crime that should have never occurred. But the problem is, I'm not the person that did that. You know, while my heart goes out to them, because of what happened, and I do truly feel sorry for them, and I continue to pray for that family despite any negative feelings they may have about me. I'm not the person that committed that crime. I cannot take responsibility for something that I did not do.
All right. We're not going to hold you much longer, but how has this, you were saying that you've sort of, your family has grown up outside of your experience. How has this affected them, your mom? You say your mom was going to be your witness. How's she doing?
It's tough. It's tough for everyone. There's many nights that my mother has cried to sleep, and, you know, other members of my family. Being, you know, the separation is indescribable. So it's been very hard. And every, you know, it, after 20 years, my mother still cries about you know, seeing me, I'm her firstborn son, being taken from our home.
At 15. And what do you remember that? Does that experience come back to you again and again? Does it guide you in a way?
You said, did it guide me?
Yeah.
I think the thing that evokes is fear. It evokes feelings of confusion, not knowing, you know, anger later on because, you know, you don't know. I didn't even know what was going on.
Are you angry now? Is that a motivating force?
I'm not angry anymore. I've had to deal with that years ago, replacing anger with a positive energy, or, you know, transforming that into positive.
You have 1 minute left.
Doing positive things with my life. I can't harbor anger or ill feelings towards people because of this experience. I have to move forward with my life.
All right, final words for the people listening to Pacifica Radio. You've got about 10 seconds, I'm sure.
I want to thank you for everyone for listening to our story. I invite people to go look at the website to learn more. They could go to www.4EFREN.com. And right now we're trying to get letters to the governor to support my release, and hopefully we could get some listeners to help us with that.
Well, we want to thank you for taking the time to be with us, and we're going to be talking to you again.
Thank you.
Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said they shot him in his head. Shot in the head to save his country. A shot in the head to save his country. Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Yeah, did you hear what they said? What they said about his mother and how she cried. They said she cried 'cause her only son was dead. They said she cried 'cause her only son was dead. Woman, could you imagine if your
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoint's broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.